With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm Mike Warren. That's Jonah Goldberg. That's Steve Hayes. We won't be dwelling too much on the presidential race this week. Instead, we're going to dive into the whirlwind weeks ahead for House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and the House of Representatives. We'll also have a lengthy discussion about the state of the world, or at least some important areas of it, and what America's role is right now, where it should be. Finally, we'll revisit one question about President Joe Biden we got into last week. All of that coming up. Well, Congress is back from its August recess and things are happening. One Republican congressman called it a perfect storm, and that seems like an apt phrase. We've got a spending fight looming as the big omnibus spending bill currently funding the government runs out at the end of the fiscal year. And for you non-green eye shade people, that's September 30th. On top of that, we've got a formal impeachment inquiry announced by Kevin McCarthy this week, having the three committees investigating Hunter Biden, his businesses, and any possible corrupt connections to Joe Biden jointly pursuing that inquiry. This is all coming as, once again, House conservatives are crowing about giving McCarthy the boot. The big problem with that is, who wants it? Who wants the job? Not me. Oh, and a non-insignificant number of elected members of Congress are very old and possibly infirm. Jonah, when I look at Capitol Hill, I feel a bit like Lloyd Christmas in Dumb and Dumber when he says, we've got no food, we got no jobs, our pets' heads are falling off. Tell me it's all going to be okay.
Oh, it's not going to be okay. It's a hot mess. And you know, it's getting worse because people like Mitt Romney are leaving. And I think it's likely that people like Mitch McConnell, you know, sooner rather than later in the grand scheme of things, won't be there either. And so a lot of the grown-ups are leaving. And that's on the Senate side, which is more grown up than the House side. So I kind of have a weird take on the Kevin McCarthy thing, insofar as I don't think the impeachment thing is really a way for him to try to keep Freedom Caucus from shutting down the government. And if you actually look at what he proposed, it's not actually changing anything that hasn't already been happening. What's his face? Jim Jordan and Representative Comer, they're not going to like dissolve their committees to form a special investigative impeachment committee thing. It's a little, someone was, because I'm driving cross country, I listened to a lot of podcasts in the last 48 hours. Someone was making this point, and I think it's right. It's a little bit like the David Weiss appointment as a special counsel to investigate Hunter. He was already the prosecutor doing it. He has not really actually become in a meaningful way a special counsel, but he gets to call himself one. It doesn't really change anything that the guy was doing. Similarly, I don't think the actual investigation, because we're calling it an impeachment inquiry, changes in a significant way. But it does buy, I think McCarthy thinks it buys him some time to keep the Freedom Caucus from shutting down the government and keeping him off his back with the motion to vacate the chair. At the same time, lest people think I'm just criticizing McCarthy on the impeachment stuff, I do not, for the life of me, understand how the White House and all of the defenders, including all the people in the media, can simply say there is zero evidence that Biden did anything wrong. Now, there's a difference between evidence and proof. There's different kinds of evidence. Circumstantial evidence is not dispositive. It never is, or I shouldn't say never is. It rarely is. But there's real evidence. I mean, there's testimony from people alleging troubling things. There are bank accounts and LLCs that we haven't had a good explanation for. We know, I mean, it's evidence by inference to a certain extent that, but Biden lied about his relationship with Hunter and whether he'd ever talked about business stuff. So I think there's like, there's real stuff there. I don't think it, they have anything close to the evidence required for an actual impeachment, never mind an impeachment conviction in the Senate, but everybody's sort of retreating to their corners and there's just a lot of kabuki going on, which seems even more kabuki-esque as I drive headlong into the West, into the new frontier, away from all of this craziness.
But I mean, it seems that evidence of possible bad things, possible bad behavior, or possible inadvisable behavior by the president doesn't rise yet, as it stands, to the level of impeachable.
Agreed.
But the investigations, as you point out, Jonah, were already going on. Steve, does Kevin McCarthy's use of the I word here, of impeachment, of sort of formally declaring it, which basically has the power of formally declaring it an impeachment inquiry and not much else, does that poison the well anymore? Or was this already, Democrats were never going to get on board, even moderates, even people like Jared Golden in Maine, were never going to get on board with anything that would nail Joe Biden. And Republicans and Kevin McCarthy are just kind of jumping ahead to where this was already going, which was an impeachment inquiry that isn't probably going to go anywhere. What strategic benefit did this serve impeachment to do it now?
Well, you know, I don't know if people can see you, Mike, but you not only feel like Lloyd Christmas from Dumb and Dumber, if people could see your haircut, you look like Lloyd Christmas from Dumb and Dumber.
Thank you. No gap in the teeth, though. Thank you very much.
I think the main purpose for Kevin McCarthy doing what he's done in announcing an impeachment inquiry is to help Donald Trump in the presidential election. I think he wants to be able to say, wants, Frank, you know, voters across the country to be able to read headlines that say, you know, House launches Joe Biden impeachment inquiry. And if you look at headlines from newspapers across the country, many of them carried those headlines. And without going much deeper, as many voters won't, they will think, oh, Donald Trump was impeached, Joe Biden was impeached, and come to the conclusion that either everybody's corrupt and everybody does things worthy of being impeached, even if Joe Biden is not actually likely to be impeached. Or they will say, boy, Washington is so partisan and so broken. People are taking shots at one another. You know, how do I choose who's good and who's bad? And I think McCarthy probably accomplished that. We know there was reporting in Politico a couple of days ago that Donald Trump has been coordinating with House Republicans, including Elise Stefanik and others in leadership, about this. He's been making open calls on social media calling for Joe Biden's impeachment, not really making a sort of solid case about exactly why, or not showing that he has any deep understanding of the evidence. And I agree with Jonah, there is evidence that's problematic for Joe Biden, instead just saying you should do it to him because he did it to me. So I think if you sort of stop and take a step back, that's really why this is happening. Whatever the Freedom Caucus machinations are, whatever the internal House politics are, that's the sort of the biggest argument.
You know, I spoke this week with Ken Buck, who's a conservative Republican congressman from Colorado. I mean, the idea that his conservative credentials could be in question is absurd. He is as conservative as they get. And he has been outspoken, and I spoke with him about this. He offers this essentially, when you put it that way, Steve, a very quaint pushback against the idea that now is the time to impeach Biden. Again, he comes back to the question of evidence. He is a career prosecutor himself. He says, I've been trying to get people to understand that if we're going to pursue this, we're going to need Democrats on board. We're going to need, lots of evidence that gets us to the point of proof. There's more work to be done. And I'm sitting there listening to him, nodding my head. That makes sense. That seems like responsible, good government. And then I hear you make the very correct point that none of that matters. This is about optics. This is about politics. This is about muddying the waters. What is the point? And it brings me to this. If we can veer a little bit away from impeachment and broaden it out a little bit to the announced retirement of Mitt Romney, it just brings me to think about how serious people, no matter their ideology in Congress, particularly on the Republican side, have to be looking at the situation and throwing up their hands the way Mitt Romney seems to be doing and saying, this is not worth it. That's pretty grim, Steve.
It's very grim. Yeah, look, I mean, you know, we don't really have themes, or at least we don't have themes on purpose on this podcast. But one of the things we talk about pretty consistently is this idea of performative politics and what it's done to governance, what it's done to what happens in Washington, D.C. And I think that's what we're seeing here. I think that's what we're seeing here with a lot of the dancing around on spending. You know, you have Republicans who suddenly cared tremendously about spending, who didn't care at all about spending under Donald Trump, or to the extent that they cared about spending under Donald Trump, they wanted more. They supported his calls for more spending, most of them. And now they're willing to shut down the government to get, you know, what are, I would say, relatively minor in the scheme of things, changes to discretionary spending. This is not serious. This is all about performative politics and getting hits on Fox News or praise on Steve Bannon's podcast. And it's frustrating. Yeah, I think it's frustrating to those of us who observe it from the outside. But as it happens, I talked to two Republican members of the House yesterday and talked about exactly this. These are serious people. They came to Washington to do serious things. They're conservatives. Everybody would describe them as conservatives. And they said, I'm just done with this. This is so frustrating. And voiced sort of the kinds of concerns about where this is going that we've often expressed on this podcast. And the real fear is, and we're seeing it, as you guys both noted, with Mitt Romney's departure, is that just good people will leave. They don't want to do this anymore. If you come to Washington, you subject yourself to the kind of scrutiny that running for office requires these days, and you are willing to, you know, spend hours in a dank basement making fundraising calls to hand over to the leadership of your party in either chamber so that you have the privilege of remaining in Congress, you want to be able to do something in addition to sort of spinning your wheels on the fundraising stuff. And as you figure out that, as more and more members of Congress figure out that they just can't do much, because the performative people are running things or driving the debate, winning the arguments, leading leadership around, good people are just going to continue to leave. And, you know, we've seen that. You go back to the when I was doing a lot more reporting, many of the really good people that I had as my sources in Congress are gone now. They've just said, forget it. And, you know, when I was doing more reporting, I sought out the people I thought were smartest, most thoughtful, people likely to be in leadership, people already in leadership. And there are just a lot fewer of those people to call on these days.
That's right. Jonah, I want to tie this into the spending fight because, you know, Steve raised a good point about the kind of silliness when you look at the grand scheme of the what's driving the debt, the deficit, and the budget. It's not these discretionary programs. You can, you know, nip and tuck here. Of course, it's non-discretionary. It's the entitlement programs. And all of what Steve just described about good people throwing up their hands and say, I'm done with this, and allowing the vacuum to be filled by the performance artists, you pair that with the unseriousness about spending. Isn't this just all our fault, as in the American people? I mean, this isn't this the government that we deserve at this point? We like the entertainment. We don't want to make hard choices about spending. We blame leaders in Washington, but shouldn't we blame ourselves?
I like that this is a very deep cut of ultramontane counter-enlightenment intellectual Comte Joseph de Maistre, who actually is the guy who first said people get the government they deserve, or something to those lines. And he wanted to restore the monarchy and all that kind of stuff. So
for the record, I do not want to restore the monarchy.
make me a case. Yeah, of course. There's a better Enlightenment figure was Adam Smith, who said there's a lot of ruin in a nation, right? America has always had problems, and we've been able to sort of deal with our problems. And sometimes we dealt with the problems by kicking the can down the road and dealing with the problems that are dealable. The problem with the financial crisis is that it's like can kicking is no longer a responsible. You can't make really a good responsible argument about it anymore. In the process of accumulating so much debt for so long, Americans have been acculturated to the fact that, acculturated to the belief that it doesn't matter, right? And one of the things that did that is that they've seen their political leaders get very, very concerned about the debt and deficits only when the other party is in power. And you can't, you know, and so there's a lot of blame to go around. I gotta be careful. I'm in Cheney country. But, you know, Dick Cheney famously said that, you know, Reagan proved that that deficits don't matter in terms of politics or in elections, whatever. I still think Cheney is more responsible than a lot of the clowns we got today. But Joe Biden doesn't care about debt and deficits. Barack Obama didn't care about debt and deficits. George W. Bush didn't care about debt and deficits. I mean, you can make a better case for Bush on some things, but and Donald Trump actively had contempt for any idea of fiscal restraint. And now we just don't have a public that, for understandable reasons, is willing to hear arguments from politicians, because politicians as a group have lost all of their credibility on this stuff.
But it does, and I want to move on from this real quick, but Steve, I'm just thinking back to 10 plus years ago, when sort of out of nowhere, a congressman from this state somewhere in the middle of the country called Wisconsin, proposed and pushed these ideas of reforming Social Security, and particularly Medicare, in ways that would put them on a sure fiscal footing. And he got the Republican conference, the Republican majority in the House eventually, to sign on to a budget like that. So at the same time, while the American people don't seem to, you know, have a stomach for these tough conversations, on the other hand, I mean, it does fall down to leadership. It does fall down to individual people. I'm of course talking about Paul Ryan, who's not in Congress anymore, speaking of. But I mean, this does fall to individual leaders in Washington sort of doing the hard things. Is there any reason to be hopeful that there are diamonds in the rough on Capitol Hill or waiting in the wings to be elected?
Yeah, I think, you know, in a surprising way, that there are diamonds in the rough serving in Congress. There are, you know, the kinds of people that I've spoken to over the last few days about this. They're not in a position, I think, right now to defy leadership and try to outcompete. You know, they're not going to like elbow Marjorie Taylor Greene away from the camera, or Lauren Boebert, or Jim Jordan, or these others, in order to have a conversation about entitlement reform. And if we're being honest about it, you know, what is Sean Hannity? What does he want to have them on to do? He's not going to have them on to make a detailed case going over the history of U.S. entitlements and the various prospects for reform of the drivers of our debt. Like, Sean Hannity doesn't care about that stuff. He wants somebody to come on and yell and shout about the Biden criminal family. right? That's what's getting people on TV. That's what people pay attention to. And that creates these incentives in Congress that I think are really destructive. But I think, look, Paul Ryan was in some ways was a unique political figure in a unique political moment. I remember when I talked to him about sort of why he was doing what he did. He tells this story about being up in the deer stand after Republicans lost over Thanksgiving, after Republicans lost the House in 2006, and thinking, well, very much along the lines of what I hear from some of the people I talked to today, why am I going back there? Like, what is this for? You know, this is almost 20 years ago. He's having these thoughts like, can anybody do anything? Can I actually accomplish anything? And he thought pretty serious about quitting, decided that he wasn't going to quit. But if he wasn't going to quit, he was going to go back and make sure that he worked on the big issues that he cared most about. So he went back and proposed these Medicare reforms, this path to, I think it was later the Path to Prosperity. I'm forgetting what the first
was. It the roadmap?
Yeah. And, you know, set about basically saying, that's what my career is going to be. And if this costs me my seat, it costs me my seat. And that's a pretty healthy way to approach this stuff. Remember, he had to fight his own party to do it. When he first announced this roadmap and talked about these reforms, the National Republican Congressional Committee, the body in Washington that's charged with getting Republicans elected to the House, put out word to members of the House of Representatives that they should run away from Paul Ryan's entitlement reforms, that this was political death. And so they sort of trashed one of their own as he was building this out in the lead up to the 2010 elections. But, you know, he was willing to lose a seat. He basically said, I don't really care if I remain in Congress, if I can't work on the big things. His district wasn't a deep red district, but it was a pretty safe district and his constituents liked him. So it wasn't, I'd say, a monumental risk, but he took the risk and he did these tutorials, 6, 8, 10 people at a time, walked people through the arguments for it and earned the support that way. Nothing like that is happening today. Like nobody's doing tutorials on the big issues of the day.
Right. Yeah, no, that's the problem. They're doing tutorials about how to do conservative media training, that sort of, how to go on Newsmax, how to talk and raise money for small dollar donations.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Tax Network USA. Do you owe back taxes? Pandemic relief is now over. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best possible deal. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's business or personal taxes, even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help financially resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Call 1-800-245-6000 for a private, free consultation or visit tnusa.com/dispatch.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's shift gears a bit to global affairs and foreign policy. And we should start with this prisoner exchange with Iran. As early as next week, 5 American prisoners in Iran could be released thanks to a deal brokered by the Biden administration. The catch is, we're helping unfreeze $6 billion of Iranian money that has been frozen as part of international sanctions. Critics, including a number of Republicans, say this is a ransom payment. I'm getting flashbacks to the Obama administration and these sort of Obama approach to Iran. Steve, talk a little bit about this exchange. Is are Republicans right? Is this a ransom payment? Should we be outraged about what we expect to see happen next week?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on then. Okay.
It is a ransom payment. we can just move on. Yeah, it's a ransom payment. It's outrageous. They've done this without consulting Congress, which depending on how you, depending on what you believe about whether there is sort of a secret underlying nuclear deal, which has been reported and I think makes a lot of sense when you watch what the administration has done. This is a bigger part of a, this is an, another step in a bigger deal. And we're allowing Iran to access funds that were previously withheld. And I think we can be certain that Iran will do with the funds, the things that Iran has done with its funds for the past four decades, which is in part fund terror, fund anti-American activities, continue to build its nuclear weapons program. None of this should be surprising. And you know, I think there are a number of reasons to be frustrated with what the Biden administration is doing here. So first and foremost, beyond the providing Iran funds that we know they'll use for malign activities, is making it far more likely that they're going to take hostages again in the future. You've had leaders of the IRGC, the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps, say this in public on tape. We know that these hostages, these prisoners are worth money, so we're going to take more of them. These funds, if you listen to the Biden administration, are to be restricted to humanitarian use. Even if that were true, that shouldn't give us much comfort because, of course, money is fungible. Whatever they're spending on humanitarian reasons is money that they, you know, with this new money is money that they would have had to spend for those same things with less money, which gives them freedom to spend.
Also, Steve, just because I don't know if you saw this, but Raisi, the president of Iran, gave an interview with Lester Holt, and Lester Holt was like, you know, well, you're going to spend this on humanitarian things. And no, nah, we're going to spend it on whatever we want. So like the Biden, even that talking about, which was always stupid, you know, the idea that like, hey, I'll pay your mortgage for a month, but you can't spend that money, the money you save on hookers and blow, is just, you know, money is fungible. But they're not even playing that game, which is they're beclowning the Biden administration.
They're mocking them. Here's the exact quote. Iranian President Raisi says, we will spend the $6 billion wherever we see fit. And Lester Holt follows up and says, this won't just be spent on food, medicine, and humanitarian goods, which again, as Jonah points out, is the Biden administration line. And Raisi says, humanitarian means whatever the Iranian people need. I mean, not serious. The final point I'll make real quick is this, the sort of additional details of this deal were announced or confirmed by the State Department on 9/11, which is just a really bad look when you think of the fact that many senior al-Qaeda leaders are being harbored or at least allowed to operate freely in Iran, and that we know Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, other al-Qaeda leaders had seen Iran and the sort of on-again, off-again, mutually exploitative relationship that they had with Iran as absolutely crucial to the growth of al-Qaeda. When our military raided Osama bin Laden's compound and captured this treasure trove of intelligence, one of the things that we found was a letter from Osama bin Laden in which he wrote, quote, Iran is our main artery for funds, personnel, and communication. And the U.S. Treasury Department under then President Barack Obama used this intelligence that we gathered to make serious designations of both Iranian regime officials and al-Qaeda individuals. So the idea that this would be confirmed on September 11th was, you know, more than just tone deaf. It was really pretty outrageous.
Jonah, I've tried to approach both the Biden and the previously the Obama administration's Iran policy, at least try to think of it in terms of good faith, you know, accepting a bit of their argument that, look, this is about preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And I keep coming up against this idea that they seem to be pursuing the idea of a deal at the expense of everything else, that that no matter what they do, Iran continues to get closer to a nuclear weapon. And yet the deal seems to be a deal. Some kind of deal seems to continue to be the object of pursuit, again, at the expense of everything else. Are we having redux here? Is there sort of a group, a number of people who in Washington, in the blob in Washington, the State Department, or where else, just pursuing a deal for the sake of it? Have they lost the plot on Iran, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's something else. I think this is one of these things where it always reminds these kinds of situations. One of my favorite movies is Bridge on the River Kwai, where Alec Guinness plays Colonel Nicholson, who decides he's a prisoner of war in Japan, or in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And he decides he's going to show up the Japanese by using his own soldiers to make a better bridge than the Japanese ever could, because they have better engineers and blah, 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 blah. And he loses the plot and realizes, you know, I won't give out the spoiler, but, you know, he realizes that he's actually aiding the Japanese in their war effort. And as, you know, this spoiler alert, he has this, my God, what have I done moment. And I think that, you know, like my friend Charlie Cook compares it to, like, there are certain liberals who are just obsessed how we need to have, like, more trains in this country. And you say, well, what's the problem that it's solving to have more trains? And the problem is the lack of trains, right? It's like, right. And there is this thing that has gone deep into certain parts of the Democratic foreign policy establishment that thinks we need to have an Iran deal to solve the problem of not having an Iran deal. And it becomes this sort of self-justifying kind of thing. And when you point out stuff like, look, there's a realpolitik argument. I have friends at AEI who are serious people who on net were like, I'm better to have the Iran deal than not, because it at least delays the nuclear program for a decade. And I kind of disagree with them. But like, if you have open eyes and you realize that the Iran deal, as Obama put it out, was not actually going to prevent a nuclear bomb or a nuclear weapon program, it was simply going to, at best, delay it a little while, then I can have a conversation with you, right? Then we can talk about, like, well, what are we going to do with that delay to sort of, what is that time buying us to do? And at some point, that part of the equation seems to have just dropped out, like, you know, like a muffler out of an old car. And it's just this idea of getting a deal to have said we got a deal. And I think this kind of thing, for weird reasons, I think this kind of thing comes up historically in arms control more than in other things. There was this obsession with arms control, you know, in the 80s, 70s and 80s, obviously. And I'm not saying I'm against all arms control with nuclear weapons and all that kind of stuff. But there was this whole body of thought that said, if we're not making forward progress, we're like sharks. We have to swim or we drown. We're like riding a bike. If we're not pedaling forward, we're going to fall over and be a nuclear cinder or something like that. And I think that sort of logic takes over certain bureaucracies. And so again, with this, I'm softer on the hostage payment ransom stuff. I don't like it. I would like to think I wouldn't have done it. But every administration screws up that kind of stuff because it's just really hard internally not to try to bring people home and that kind of thing. But you get this sense with all of this weird stuff with Robert Malley, which I can't explain, and maybe Steve can. But you get the sense that
who's the Iran envoy, the U.S. envoy, Biden administration's envoy to Iran, been suspended. Yeah.
Right. Who's been sidelined for mishandling classified information, and we don't have any more information than that, really. And which is just sort of bonkers. And one gets the sense that, you know, remember, I keep thinking about it, right after 9/11, since we're right after the anniversary of 9/11, there was this wonderful piece in the New Republic about how crazy Joe Biden was, right? So this is not a senility point. This is 22 years ago. And right after 9/11, he's having a meeting with his foreign policy team, because I guess he was the chairman of the Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs Committee or something. And they're talking about, how do we respond to the fact that we just had these buildings knocked down and all these people, all Americans were killed? And he says, you know what we should, know what we should do? We should cut a check to the Iranians for $150 million. Just to show that we're not angry at them and we don't think they're part of this, whatever. And the entire room is just sort of like, don't interrupt him. Don't respond. He'll move on to talking about something else in a second. And we don't have to follow up on this. But if we fight him on this, he'll dig in, right? Biden has this weird mindset about Iran that I think goes way back. And he's having arguments in his head with people he had arguments with 30 years ago and 20 years ago about stuff that doesn't apply today. And I think it infects his entire team.
Yeah, that scene, it's like every time Steve brings up that the Dispatch should invest in a Spanish winery,
right,
you know, at editorial meetings. And we all sort of sit there and wait for him to get through it and move on.
It's like the Downfall video where we all just have these knowing looks at each other and they're like, let Steve keep talking. No one's saying.
but my that prospect has the chance of really turning out well and succeeding. And the Biden's Iran policy doesn't.
All right. Well, from one, I guess, aspirational nuclear power to two actual nuclear powers. This week, Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin held a summit together in which these two strongmen, I guess, vowed to be BFFs forever and ever. This is from the Associated Press. North Korea's Kim Jong-un vowed, quote, full and unconditional support for Russia's Vladimir Putin at this summit in the Russian Far East. The AP continues, this meeting, which lasted over 4 hours at Russia's spaceport in the Far East, underscores how the two countries' interests are aligning. Putin is believed to be seeking one of the few things impoverished North Korea has in abundance: stockpiles of aging ammunition and rockets for Soviet-era weapons. Nothing to see here, right? Nothing to be alarmed about, Steve. Just two strong men with nuclear weapons and anti-American views getting along.
Yeah, 2 points. One about the Russians and the North Koreans, and then another point about the Biden administration's foreign policy incoherence, which I think this highlights in some respects. Look, it's very interesting. We have a terrific sort of reported analysis on this meeting in Thursday's Morning Dispatch. We'll pop it in the show notes so people can read it. But I mean, it really tells you something about Vladimir Putin that he would seek this kind of help from North Korea. It suggests that he's in pretty desperate straits. And if the North Koreans are providing this to him in a way that actually helps his war effort, I think it suggests that his ability to play this out over the long term, which has long been assumed to be a huge advantage for Russia, is at least more questionable than the people making that claim might have suspected initially. You don't want to be going to, you know, one of the poorest countries on earth, this hermit kingdom, seeking real help for your war effort. But second, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, the Biden administration, was asked about this meeting and what it meant. And he had, you know, sort of tough sounding language on North Korea, and said, in effect, you know, North Korea will be isolated from the international community and will be punished for supporting Russia in its aggressive war against Ukraine. And then you stop and think, I think he said this either on the same day or within a day or two of the Biden administration announcing that it was freeing up this $6 billion to Iran, which is also providing Russia arms, weaponry for its fight against Ukraine. Who's going to believe that? Like, how do you square that circle? It's a level of sort of foreign policy incoherence that I suppose it shouldn't be surprising. At this point, I think we saw this kind of naive realpolitik throughout the Obama administration. But this is sort of crazy. How can you threaten North Korea for doing something, potentially doing something that Iran is already doing when you're rewarding Iran, or not, at least not punishing Iran in the same way? Sort of further, deeper incoherence from the Biden administration on these issues.
Jonah, do you have any thoughts on the big summit with Putin and Kim? And I think we should also explore some more this incoherence idea of the Biden administration's foreign policy, which, you know, say what you want about the Trump foreign policy. It was always sort of keeping other people, enemies, people like North Korea and China sort of on their toes. This is really just sort of incoherent, as Steve said. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm going to get nostalgic for Donald Trump's North Korea policies, but
no.
And he must be pretty jealous, because he, you know, one of the things he took with him was the love letters between him and Kim Jong-un, and he loves to show them to people. And now, you know, Kim Jong-un is dating Putin instead of him, and that's got to bother him. But I hadn't thought about it until I was just listening to Steve. I think part of the incoherence part comes from, it's sort of metaphorically like this point about fungible money, right? If you give money to Iran, or you free up Iranian money for Iran, for, and you say, well, this is for humanitarian stuff, and you don't realize that, like, even if they were going to honor that commitment, which they're clearly not, freeing up $6 billion, you know, getting $6 billion for this stuff frees up $6 billion for other stuff. Politically, it's the same thing with sort of political capital, where it's sort of like the Biden administration's policy towards China. You know, whenever you listen to John Kerry about how they're going to negotiate things about climate change on a completely different track from everything else. And they think, because one guy at the office has the folder for this, it has no relationship to the guy down the hall who has the folder for that. When all the foreign governments are like, okay, here are the five things the US wants, and it's blah, 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 climate, blah, 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 weapons, blah, 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 terrorism. They don't see these as like separate tracks to negotiate or anything like that. They just see it as sort of leverage and power. But if you actually have this sort of bureaucratic, sort of intellectual mindset where you compartmentalize issues and problems in those ways as you deal with things in foreign policy, it's invariably going to look incoherent from the outside, because it's incoherent. The only other thing I'd say is, I think there's something reassuring, as terrible as this is. You know, Iran's sending drones to Russia. Now North Korea is going to send artillery shells, which I hope some of them we find out. I have a 50-50 kind of hope here that we're going to find out that a lot of North Korea's munitions are in really terrible shape. And we may hear about like Russian artillery batteries blowing up when they try to shoot some of this stuff. But it does sort of underscore why bad governments, bad states, villains end up hanging out with each other. And, you know, it's sort of like, go back to the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, right? There's a reason why the Nazis and the Soviets cut a deal, because autocrats it's really hard for dictators and totalitarians find it really difficult to deal with Western countries that have standards and care about some principles and human rights and democracy and all that kind of stuff. And it's just really, really easy to deal with other people who can autocratically make a decision, make a handshake deal, and not give you a hard time about anything. And what's reassuring about this, with the marginal exception of China, which is just more complicated, all of these countries are second-rate countries or third-rate countries. Being a totalitarian, being an autocrat, contrary to what some of our friends on the post-liberal right want to tell you these days, makes your country weaker and more pathetic. I mean, it may make your military stronger in a narrow sense, but like North Korea is strong but super brittle, right? Russia, we're finding out that its military was nowhere near what everyone thought it was on paper. I suspect that's true of North Korea too. These Moreover, these are just crappy countries to live in. These are crappy countries to raise your kids in. And if people think I'm being too harsh on North Korea, suck it up, because I'm being 100% accurate. And I'm not going to apologize for it. It's an evil totalitarian state that has, you know, slavery and caste systems. And there's just a reason why bad countries end up forming clubs with each other. It's because they're the only ones that will have a stomach for hanging out with each other.
I'm thinking of the opening scene in The Naked Gun.
I think about that all the time.
Yeah, and Frank Drebin breaks into the room. Yes, of I think Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah and everybody else. Steve, the other thing about this meeting between Putin and Kim, and maybe this is a pedestrian point, but I think it's important. It's a reminder. It's a reminder that we live in a global world, and Russia is a country that stretches across two continents, and what happens in its relationship with North Korea affects what's happening in its war in Ukraine. And it really does, to underscore Jonah's point, sort of undercuts the new right's approach to foreign policy, which does have a sort of compartmentalization. We should be worrying about China and not what's happening in Eastern Europe. But of course, these are all one thing affects the other.
Yeah. I mean, it is ironic, I think. And there are some through lines between the supposed realpolitik or realist approach that Joe Biden is offering or has been said to offer the Obama administration as well. Remember, Barack Obama was going to move us away from ideology-driven foreign policy and national security policy to sort of a hard-nosed assessment of U.S. interests and conduct his foreign policy that way. I think if you look at what Joe Biden, I mean, to the extent that you can make sense of what Joe Biden is doing, he's naive and I think in some cases delusional, but just in the other direction. I mean, just as it relates to our enemies in some ways. He hasn't been this way, certainly on Vladimir Putin, although I have my criticism of how late we've been on virtually everything. We eventually do the right thing, but it takes us a long time, and that time elapsed has costs to it. But if you look at the approach to Iran, you know, there are these echoes of the Obama administration's approach. Barack Obama's team literally talked about decoupling. That was their phrase. We are going to decouple nuclear talks from everything else the regime is doing. But the nature of the regimes in these cases, particularly when you're dealing with rogue states, matters a lot. That should, in my view, tell you how you should approach the regimes. We know a lot about the nature of the Iranian regime that doesn't allow us to neatly separate, sort of the actual diplomatic language in the Iran deal. You need to know whether you think it's likely they're going to follow this. You need to know what the likely outcomes are. And, you know, sometimes it feels like excuse making, both from people making these arguments on the new right and from people making these arguments on the realist left, so that they don't have to do, I think, some of the hard things that the United States has to do. That doesn't mean we need to be the world's policeman, but in my view, for exactly the reasons you suggested, you know, the world is an interconnected place. The United States should do what it can to use its influence to create alliances or a world order that benefits the United States. And as often as not, that requires us to try to determine outcomes. It doesn't mean that or try to influence outcomes, if not determine outcomes. It doesn't mean that we should go charging into every dispute with our own troops or throw our weight around making demands that we can't follow up. But it does mean that where you're able to influence outcomes, we should try to influence outcomes.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, well, let's revisit a topic we discussed last week. We got into it a little bit, the questions, and I will say we will get into now presidential politics, but not on the Republican side. There were polling results from last week that suggested that there are a number of voters who are concerned about Joe Biden's fitness for office. And when I say that, I mean physical fitness, his age, his ability to carry out the duties of the president for another term. And this comes, is followed shortly thereafter by a column from David Ignatius, who I would say is sort of the most, maybe the dean of the mainstream liberal punditry core in the Washington Post. He suspends several paragraphs this week, building up Joe Biden and all of his accomplishments. And he gets down almost near the end of the column to say this, quote, "Biden has another chance to say no to himself this time by withdrawing from the 2024 race. It might not be in character for Biden, but it would be a wise choice for the country." The number one or one of the top liberal columnists read in the Biden White House, urging Biden not to run again in 2024. Jonah, what do you make of this? Why is this happening now?
I think partly it's the panic setting in. I think that, I mean, look, let's just be clear. Like Mitt Romney, God bless him, you know, says I would be in my mid-80s. No one's worried about Mitt Romney's age, right? People age at different rates. And so when people talk about age, what they're really talking about is cognitive ability. But age is a shorthand for that. And there are a lot of people, defenders of Joe Biden, who really want to make it want to confuse the issue as if like they can talk themselves out of the problem. And the idea that the Joe Biden that people see is different behind the scenes is just not persuasive to anybody. And in fact, it's probably like the case that he is more old seeming, more sort of
fuddled.
A little more foggy. Off camera than on, because he realizes he can't see. He's got a political problem about how he is perceived when he's in front of a camera. So he's trying harder. But like when you're in a meeting, you let your guard down more. And my hunch is that a lot of people are seeing it and you hear stories about it. And I think it's just dawning on people that as flawed as it is to look at polling a year out, more than a year out, 18 months out, or whatever it is, from a presidential election, in any sort of granular way as predictive, directionally, these polls tell you that Joe Biden is much more vulnerable than people want to admit. And so I think but I don't have any grander theory than this. It's sort of like, it's one of these things where you can't spin your way out of something. Like you can spin debt and deficit stuff. People do it all the time. We talked about this earlier. Every single American, or nearly every single American, has a relative or a friend or a loved one of some kind who they've seen these signs in before, and they recognize it. Now, it doesn't mean he's a vegetable or he's about to be a mess, but when you tell people there's no there, they just know they're being lied to. And I think that that's just a fundamental political problem that they're struggling with.
Steve, you have an active bet with our colleague Sarah Isger that one of your bets is that Biden will not be the nominee in 2024. So I need to ask you, did you somehow slip David Ignatius, knowing he's read in the Biden White House something, some kind of payment to write this column to help your bet? What's come clean?
I did not. You know, I know David Ignatius a little bit. I think he's a sharp columnist. He usually has. If you want to, as I think Jonah said, if you want to tap into the thinking, particularly on national security and foreign policy, of the sort of Democratic intelligentsia, Democratic establishment, David Ignatius is the way. He regularly, and it's true of sort of the establishments beyond sort of partisan. He had very good sources forever at the top of the leadership of CIA and the director of national intelligence, but I did not. We didn't agree on everything all the times, even though we were friendly. I did not slip him a note to win my bet. But I think Jonah's point, it can't sort of be emphasized enough. It's weird to listen to, the White House, the White House of the Biden campaign. They don't really have a choice but to try to spin this in whatever way they can, right? So you have this wave of polls come out, and then you have responding to it a series of arguments or op-eds or pushback from Biden partisans, effectively telling voters that what they're seeing is not what they're seeing. And that's the problem. It's not that voters are suddenly waking up and saying, oh, my gosh, I know his exact age. And that's the problem. It's that it's what they're seeing him do and what the White House is doing with and about him. I mean, he looked like he fell asleep in a meeting with the Israeli president back in June. He's had all of these gaffes. He looks like he's lost sometimes when he's speaking. The White House
in Vietnam, he said, I got to go take a nap. Right.
I mean, like he said, I've got to go to bed. And it came the irony of that statement. I mean, there have been a couple of these moments on this latest trip. And the irony of that is it comes on the heels of these protestations from Biden partisans that he's, you know, full of vim and vigor. And oh, by the way, he's racing around the world. So how dare you suggest that he's too tired for the job? I mean, that was the line for about 3 days. And then Biden, you know, he on a couple of different answers back to back, made no sense at all, clearly lost his train of thought. Like he couldn't follow it up. Now, that happens to me. That happens to all of us. But it happens with great frequency to the president of the United States. And when he then announces that he's got to go to bed, like that would be something that I might say after a long trip to a different continent. But it comes at a time when people are really wondering whether he can do the job. And it's not accurate to say every appearance, but many of his appearances have the effect of affirming what voters have increasingly come to believe, that the guy is just too old. How do you campaign for the next 13, 14 months to try to disprove that when his very presence often affirms it? This is a very difficult dilemma. And that, as to go to your original question, Mike, that's why you're seeing people say this now, is because Democrats have long been concerned that Biden isn't going to he won't be able to campaign in a strong way through the election. That's why you're hearing people say this now.
So I have a theory about this, two theories. One, I think one of the problems about talking about this stuff is it's sort of like the impeachment. Everyone's going to go to their corners. They're going to say any criticism is partisan, whatever. And I think one of the things a lot of liberals who defend Biden don't actually understand about a lot of conservatives who are bringing up this point is that most of the conservatives, there are pro-Trump people who are all in for Trump, and they're like the guys, you know, they're like attacking Biden as senile and all that kind of stuff. And then there are a bunch of people who really don't want Trump to be president again, who are saying, hey, we're pointing this out while there's time to fix it, because this guy could really lose. And I think one of the things which we didn't mention, which I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, the Mitch McConnell thing is really kind of hammering it home for a lot of people. Because even if you buy the Mitch McConnell story, which I do for the most part, that this is all just from a concussion. Well, old people fall down. And if Joe Biden had the same effects from a concussion that Mitch McConnell did, you'd have to talk about maybe implementing the 25th Amendment for a while. That's not great, Bob. And I think the assumption of bad faith on the part of anybody who talks about this is one of the things that causes people who have the ability to do something about this to sort of lock in and refuse to do it. And obviously the other part of the problem is Kamala Harris is an insurmountable bottleneck politically, because people think that she would do even worse than Joe Biden. But the other theory I had, and I'm going to have a Biden moment while I try to remember what it is. Oh.
Jonah, don't run for president.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. I think the thing that Biden needs to do, like, you get in trouble in politics when you pretend that you're something you're not. Right. And right. If you're not an intellectual, don't try to talk like one. If you're not funny, don't try too hard to be funny. Joe Biden's got to stop talking about how he can do push-ups or whatever, that kind of nonsense. They should start cutting ads with him sitting on a porch, whittling a piece of wood, drinking some iced tea or some lemonade, owning his
age. Some Werther's Originals.
Yeah, owning his age, right? In this way that Lloyd Benson kind of owned his age. And I think that would be me. That would be far more reassuring to a lot of voters if he seemed to be acknowledging that he knows he's got this issue than him trying to pretend that he doesn't, because that disconnect, I think, really bothers a lot of people.
Yeah. So I'm not sure you're right that owning it. I mean, you know, that's often when you have a what do they say, that you take your biggest problem and hang a lantern on it, like shine a light on mm-hmm. it, like own it, be honest and transparent and work your way through it. I'm not sure that works in this case, but it's hard to imagine it working less than what they're currently yeah. doing, which is just saying to people, you're not. Yeah, you're
I'm
not.
I think it's a good option. I mean, the best option is to be 40 years younger.
right. But they're effectively what they're saying now to voters is like, you're not seeing what you tell us you're seeing, and you shouldn't be concerned by what you say you're concerned about. I mean, that's like, you can't, that's not going to work. That's not going to be very effective. Two quick points just on to pick up on Jonah's point there. Look, I've mentioned this here before. I talked to senior Biden advisors in anticipation of his run in 2020. And, you know, even going back further, and people had these concerns. Biden people had these concerns about Biden in his debate prep, in other private settings. They worried about his ability to sort of track and move forward. Those people weren't saying these things because they are hostile to Joe Biden. They were saying these things because they just had these concerns. Second, there was this book that we talked about here. We interviewed the co-authors back in the day by Jonathan Martin and Alex Burns, then at the New York Times. It was a book that looked at the transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. A lot of really great fresh reporting about what was happening in Trump world, but also and January 6th and sort of taking us through that chaos, but also really good reporting, didn't get as much attention, on Joe Biden and what was going on in Biden world. And they have detailed passages in that book, interviews with top Democrats, talking about this, talking openly. This is a big concern. And I remember when we did the podcast with them, and we'll post that in the show notes too, I asked them about this. I said, so, you know, is this a concern? And Alex Burns, now both Burns and Martin are at Politico, said it's a major concern. Like, people are really, really worried about this. They were talking about Democrats who are concerned about this. So I think Jonah's right. People are inclined in a partisan environment, and the way that Washington works, the way that too much of the country works these days, to go to their partisan corners. But it's nonsense. Democrats are concerned about it. That's why you're seeing people like David Ignatius, Dean Phillips from Minnesota, who's calling for a competitive primary, and others begin to speak out about this, because these are the conversations that have been taking place behind the scenes about Joe Biden literally now for years.
Well, as we close out, my only thought on this is there is a problem. You mentioned, Jonah, everybody knows somebody, has a family member, a friend, a neighbor who they've seen this happen to. You know who votes a lot are people in their 70s and 80s. And these are people who know themselves, know their peers, mm-hmm. and are watching Joe Biden as well. This, I think, is a problem, particularly with those voters. My own anecdata, talking with people that I know in my life at that age who are open swing voters, they're talking about this. You would think that maybe they would be defensive themselves, but no, of course, they know what it's like to be 80, 81, 82 years old. So definitely something that that everybody is going to be watching. Thanks so much for listening. Join us at thedispatch.com. Join us, become a member, and we'll talk to you next time.
Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.